When we turn to the vices of vainglory and pride, it is necessary to look at them together for the simple but sometimes rather difficult reason that they are not always clearly distinguished from one another in the early monastic literature. And even today, the terms can be used in an overlapping sort of way. There is a kind of an overlap between them. And so one will find, particularly in John Cassian, that it's sometimes hard to tell what he means to you have as a distinction between these different vices, between these different logismoi. It's a little bit clearer in Evagrius, as we will see, but we will try here to suggest a distinction while at the same time acknowledging the fact that there is considerable overlap and sometimes the terms are not used with the precision that we'll try to suggest in this introductory section. In the first bit of text before you, I've tried to summarize both the fact of overlap and also noting the fact that the remedies that are used to overcome them are often the same. Often the same remedies will be recommended for both vainglory and for pride, particularly the use of humility or the recommendation of the virtue of humility. But as we'll see, if we can distinguish somewhat between them, we can also tease out other remedies and perceive different aspects of these that will help us understand the kind of psychological processes that these particular temptations or vices are supposed to be highlighting. One can say in general, and Evagrius is one who gives us the ability to do this, that in vainglory one is looking at something that is still oriented towards the community. It isn't as, if you will, severe or destructive as pride. Both of these represent sins temptations to forms of isolation of the self, the gradually collapsing down of the individual to the point where they imagine, although they often don't bring this to consciousness, that they really are the only thing that exists, that everything out there exists for their benefit, a kind of psychopathy. And in its extreme forms, Evagrius in the monastic tradition will say that these temptations, in particular pride, lead to madness, to a kind of insanity. They are a failure to acknowledge the truth of our dependence on God and our interdependence on one another. And from the Evagrian standpoint, and to a lesser extent in Cassian, vainglory is not quite as severe, not quite as destructive, because you are still connected to community in vainglory. In the sin or the temptation of vainglory, one is tempted to see others primarily as a way of receiving lots and lots of positive affirmation about one's gifts. Other people become very little more than a mirror in which we expect to see reflected how wonderful we are. But bad as that is, at least it acknowledges the existence and the significance of others. To some extent, the remedy for this, or one of the remedies, will consist in a reintegration into community, a discovery again of the fact that it's within our interpersonal relationships that our gifts not only come into being, we are taught what we learn, we are dependent on one another from infancy onwards, and indeed the exercise of our gifts occurs in the context of community, so there is always a communal context, and part of the stepping out of the illusion of vainglory into the truth of what our gifts may be lies in real koinonia, lies in the discovery of what real community is for and what it's about. Pride, in its, if you will, pure form, as the monastic tradition understood it, is a much graver and much more destructive. In fact, it is the most destructive kind of sin, because one is effectively trying to imagine or create a universe in which we no longer need the grace of God, in which I as an individual exist independently. Not only do I not need other people, but I don't need God. I am responsible for my own destiny, I make my own free choices, and I don't need any interference from anyone or anything. C.S. Lewis, in his brilliant little book, The Great Divorce, points out that the soul that truly believes this, that truly experiences this, is already living in hell. And hell consists in the soul's forcing itself to continue existing in this state, where the reality of our relationship with God and our relationship with other people is, as it were, banished from the horizon. It's as if the soul becomes a kind of a psychic black hole into which it wants everything else to fall. That's pride in its worst, in its most, if you will, demonic, and it's part of the tradition according to which it is the most twisting and warping of sins, and it is indeed the sin by which the most spiritual and angelic of realities can fall. In effect, both vainglory and pride are failures to acknowledge truth. The truth, as I mentioned, about our need for one another, and especially our need for God and the grace of God, the constant gift God gives us that recreates us and allows us even to exist. If we drop down then to the word studies, I've drawn both from Kittel's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament and also from the Little and Scott Greek-English Lexicon to give us a little sense of the general semantic ranges or terms that are associated particularly with these vices and their corresponding, or if you will, their healing virtues. The term for vainglory is kenodoxia, which literally means vain or empty glory or glorying, and in its literal sense, if you look at the second definition under vainglorious, it can mean empty opinion. And so vainglory can be someone who tries to establish or believe in or maintain an empty opinion, a kind of a constant denial of the real truth, a glorying in empty distinctions, and the principal thing having to do, if you in the New Testament, with the idea under the top definition of vainglory, the idea of boasting. And there again, as we mentioned, of boasting in such a way that one needs an audience in order to appreciate how valuable and important and wonderful one is. The cure for this is proper reimmersion into the experience of koinonia, of true community. And I've given the definitions from both the classical Greek tradition and also from the New Testament. Koinonia means a communion, an association, partnership, fellowship. It implies mutuality. True vainglory is not interested in mutuality. It wants the other to be there for it. It wants the other to exist only insofar as it praises and offers adulation to the self. True community involves mutuality, partnership, fellowship, brotherly concord in Paul's sense. It's the fellowship of concord established and expressed in the life of Christian community. More than that, Paul uses this term to express also participation in one another and in God through the Eucharist. There is a koinonia, a participation, a fellowship, a mutuality that exists and which is especially experienced in the context of the celebration of the Lord's Supper. There is a Eucharistic truth to our fellowship with one another and with God. And insofar as we reimmerse ourselves in that again, insofar as we make that an active part of who we are and what we experience, we are less likely to fall into this vice of imagining that the other is for me. On the contrary, at its best, this kind of participation, as we'll see also with humility, invites me to service, to do for others what God has done for me. Christ pours himself out for our benefit and invites us to do the same in our relationships with one another, not expecting of the other, but offering to the other that which we can be. And the other important virtue associated both with the correcting of vainglory and of pride is, of course, humility, a tapeno frosune, which literally has to do with this notion of tapenos, which means to be lowly, to be even in a negative sense, it has to do with a sense of dejection. And it was often in classical Greek the way that the slaves or those who were not born of noble families were described, ordinary people. And of course, these are exactly the wonderful realities for which God died, ordinariness, ordinary people, not the exalted, not those who are highly respected or regarded, but in fact those who are regarded as of least importance. These are the ones for whom God dies, and so a solidarity with, an acknowledgement of the fact of our own absolute need for God. Here again, the recognition of our need for grace and for relationship with God becomes an essential part of humility. St. Thomas Aquinas will say, humility is truth. Both of these vices are temptations not to believe the truth. Humility is not believing lies about ourselves. C.S. Lewis particularly says this in the Screwtape Letters in a very eloquent sort of way. Humility is not claiming that we have no skills when we have them, or believing that we're, or acting as if we're stupid when we're not. Humility is acknowledging the truth about ourselves, and that will be enough to make us humble. If we recognize our own brokenness, the discord between what we ought to desire and ought to do and what we do in fact do, that will provide us with the spur that we necessarily need in order to change. True humility is exactly that. Truth, recognizing the truth about ourselves, and inviting then, as you can see at the end of that paragraph that concludes the section on humility from Kittel, according to St. Paul, the virtue of humility involves an imitation of God such that human beings can now subordinate themselves to one another in service, not because of servility, not because they're slaves or they despise themselves, but they discover the truth that we are made for relationship with one another. And a true acknowledgement of this enables us to give ourselves rather than expect from one another. If we drop down to the classical and New Testament understandings of pride, hyperephania, this literally means arrogance or contempt, holding another in contempt because one regards oneself as higher. It's generally, even in classical Greek, used in a negative sense, that which is arrogant or overweening. It can occasionally, rarely, be used in a good sense as something magnificent or sublime. But in general, this vice, as we mentioned, is a completely false estimation of the self, which has taken a step beyond vainglory to the point that it now is not even regarding others. It isn't even regarding others as a source of positive or any kind of affirmation. Suddenly, I don't need others at all, and I don't need God. It's the attempt to create a universe that doesn't exist. The only universe that exists is the one in which God makes us for relationship with himself and relationship with one another. There is no other world. But if, through our free will, we pretend that there can be a place where we are isolated by ourselves, where we don't need one another or don't need God, then our own free will has created a kind of anti-existence, which goes by the name of hell and damnation. And it's linked to this notion of pride because, again, it has to do with this delusion of independent existence, of non-reliance on, and this is the last term we look at, grace, on the grace that God gives us. This beautiful word, charis, which comes from or is related to the Greek word chaira, which means to rejoice, or to be glad, to be delighted. And so grace is God's delight. It is his gift to us, his delight in us, and also the great delight-making gift that God gives us of himself, of relationship, and which invites us to a kind of return. We are only truly ourselves when we are constantly accepting this, and it's in the last paragraph, this free unmerited grace, the gift of our salvation, the reception of the joy that God gives us in his delight in us, and then we can echo that back. We can dare to live in relationships with others that acknowledge this joy, this gift we have received, and in a sense are delighting in our insufficiency. We are not sufficient in ourselves. Pride denies the need for grace. Grace and humility acknowledge that our existence itself is the delightful acceptance of what we need, the proclamation of this wonderful interrelationship and dependence on God and on one another that is itself a foretaste of and a participation in heaven. So, pride and vainglory are the isolation of the self, the temptation to believe in the possibility of an existence without those fundamental things, and the healing, the cure, comes in recognition of our very great need to receive from God this joy-making gift, and then also to spend ourselves in the whole purpose of our existence in sharing it with others.